Soybean cyst nematode is the major pathogen of soybean and the major problem for breeders. Our breeders are currently breeding both the soybean for resistance to the cyst nematode and the nematode for the ability to overcome that resistance. They don't mean to do the latter, but that's what happens. So we have a resistance system that's really imperfect. Resistance is temperature dependent. It only works the way we think it's going to work at 26 degrees plus or minus 1. In the soil. The temperature varies much more than that. Resistance, even when we have it, is only partial. So we talk about resistance as being 10% of the cyst load on a susceptible. And that level was agreed around a big jug of beer by 5 breeders back in the 60s, end of the 60s. The genetics of resistance is complex. There are lots of genes contributing, and you'll be glad to know I'm only going to talk to you about one of those today, and that one is RHG1, and that gene is important because it's needed for resistance to all types of nematode. It's the only one that is. And of course, breeding being what it is, that RHG1 gene has not been stably tracked by breeders, so we occasionally get resistance alleles of RHG1 in susceptible cultivars, complicating the breeding process and requiring further analysis. A lot of the pioneering work in this field was done by Pioneer and David Webb, with whom I interacted in graduate school in Oregon. And David came up with a 5-gene system where G was central. A2, that had been known since the 60s, was an interacting partner, so G and M could give you resistance to race 3. G and A2 could give you a resistance to A3. What David found that was quite interesting was that there was a locus on linkage group M that had to be co-inherited with the resistance allele on linkage group G, or the bean died as an embryo, or as a zygote for that matter. So you have a GM linkage that can never be broken. And you need to bear that in mind as we start to talk about more molecular basis. Anyway, so it's a mix and match system. You must always have G. If you can add A2, you can get resistance to race 3. If you can add A2, J, and something on C, you can get resistance to race 1. If you have G, C2, J, and D2, you can have resistance to race 2, and so on and so forth. So a mix and match resistance system. We did brute force positional cloning on RHG1, and we basically have a sequence contig now from Williams 82, Asgrove 3244, and Forest for three-way comparisons. And we can look at gene content and use markers and recombinants to identify the gene. And what we have found from that is that there's a region between outside flanking it, SAT1, and inside flanking it, SAT309, where there are some genes that constitute the RHG1 locus. We are most interested, and going to talk most today, about the receptor-like kinase gene that we find right here, where we have a marker, SAC13, in the promoter region, a marker, SNP1478, in the region between the receptor-like kinase, between the leucinoid repeat and receptor-like kinase, and a marker called SIUTMD1, which is in the intron of the gene. So that's basically the thing that we're looking at. This is a TechMan assay on that SNP that was developed by Navinder recently, which helps with our analyses of how this gene contributes to resistance. The gene itself has many alleles. There are shown here 8 alleles, there are actually 9. There's an additional variant on resistant type 1, which is a synonymous change. And those alleles result in 5 different proteins. So 3 of them are derived from synonymous changes. So this is one of the reasons we believe this gene is involved and this protein is involved in resistance. The other is association mapping. We can show perfect association between any of those markers I talked about, the promoter one, the intron one, or the SNP, with race 3 resistance in, and the presence of the Peking-like allele. And that's all published. we have evidence that suggests that though the RLK itself, the receptor-like kinase at RHG1, is not the entire locus. And some of that comes from mapping. So here you can see resistant genotypes group A, 4A rather, have a recombinant here and a resistant. And resistant genotype group 6 have a recombination here and a resistant. So the implication is that everything between here and here is potentially contributing to resistance. So this is what we're looking at. The receptor-like kinase on one flank, we know if it's disrupted by recombination, resistance is lost. But equally, we know that the lacase, the NH antiporter, and these two predicted proteins in RNAi have a small effect on reducing cysts in composite plants, and that's Chris Taylor's work. RHG1 has dominance issues. In F2 populations, it appears to be recessive or codominant at best, explaining maybe 30% of the trait. But in some near isogenic line populations, like this one recently analyzed by Navinder and Afzal, we can show that the heterozygous plants, having both the resistance and susceptibility allele at the receptor-like kinase, are dominant. So these four lines are all fully resistant. So dominance shifts. And what we mean by dominance is a little bit complex, because the way this nematode works is, whether you're resistant or susceptible, the nematode infests the root, swims around for a bit looking for an infection site to set up, tests a few infection sites before it finally sets up home, and begins to develop. Resistance in Peking doesn't kick in until a couple of days after that feeding site has been initiated. And in Peking, it's a fast and aggressive kill of the nematode. In the susceptible type, then the nematodes feed happily from about 6 cells, sort of rotating their heads around from one cell to another over time and sucking out the contents. To do that, you see, they're sort of on the vasculature, but a secondary route initially set up to feed that feeding site. So the nematodes, if they're successful, mess with development. If they are not successful, then plant development messes with them. And that would be fair enough to say. So back to the receptor-like kinase at RHG1. We do know that it is expressed in roots. We can see it in some ESD collections. We can see it in this RT-PCR. We also know from using our antibody that the protein is present in roots. Here's a control with another protein that shouldn't cross-react with this antibody and clearly didn't. Here are the root samples. But we don't really see any differential expression in susceptible versus resistant in either root or protein. So it's there, but the form of it is doing something different. That made us determine that understanding the structure of the protein was going to be important. We have all of these things telling us that protein structure is important, temperature dependence, mix and match, and common expression. So we modeled, then we tested the model. The first part of the model said the most closely related structural protein was another resistance gene, the polygalacturonase inhibiting protein that's involved in fungal resistance in Phaseolus beans. But this is a little protein, and our protein is much, much bigger than that. But it told us the basic structure was an alpha-beta-beta structure with a curve. And so here's PGIP again, because he's small, and definitely single amino acid changes in this change its race specificity for fungal resistance. Our leucine-rich repeat on the receptor-like kinase, though, is more horseshoe-shaped, and here we have known resistance genes, XA21. Here's RHG1 for comparison, and here's something that was at the RHG4 locus, that was also a receptor-like kinase. Both of them can be predicted to dimerize in this horseshoe-on-horseshoe effect, which is creating a pore here to bind something that would be relatively large in scale, probably another protein, certainly not a small molecule. We don't see anything here that looks like the pocket of a small effector binding. The amino acid changes that we see between the resistance and susceptibility alleles have a profound effect on structure. All three of them are real structure breakers. So we know that it's expressed, we know that the allelic variations that have been allowed in the protein are significant. So next, we went on to try and validate those structural predictions by producing the protein, and we did it with histag protein, both short and long, and here we have the histag being purified and identified with an antibody. And then we did circular dichroism spectrometry. Circular dichroism spectrometry allows you to look at your expressed protein and say, what are the structural elements within that protein in a broad sense? It's like a preamble to doing NMR, and something you can do on proteins that maybe you can't get to the level of concentration that you need for NMR, which in our case was fortunate, because the leucine-rich repeater, they are okay, at RHG1 is not very soluble. What we can see here is a comparison of the PGIP protein, which is nicely alpha, nicely beta, and has no evidence for unstructuredness. Looks kind of similar in this part to our protein, missing this shoulder, of course. But this here throws us into the unstructured, intrinsically unstructured protein arena, which those of you who follow the Arabidopsis process will know 35% of proteins in Arabidopsis have intrinsically unstructured regions, and the hypothesis at the moment is that those regions allow for interactions between proteins that are less constrained, shall we say that, promiscuous interactions. Anyway, so having the protein in hand, we can look for physical evidence of dimerization, and here in fact on the non-denaturing gel we have dimerized protein compared to the monomer identified just with Kumasi. So this part of the model is validated, the protein will dimerize. And it left us with this list of proofs that the RLK is in fact involved in cyst resistance and is part of the RHG1 locus. It's in a family of known resistance genes, that was a smoking gun. It has markers that are associated with resistance in materials that we know share allelism with the RHG1 from Peking. It's perfectly associated in an association study of all the 112 SCN-resistant PIs that were ever identified in the germplasm collection. The protein dimerizes and present in plant roots. But then that leaves us with the question of why then do the other genes at the RHG1 sort of mildly affect SCN in the RNA composite plants? And so we go back to this interaction story that according to temperature and according to interacting partner, you can generate different resistances. Let me skip that one. So we're currently in the hunt for interacting partners, and the first step in that was to do 2D gels and try a far western approach, ask after this very artificial system of isoelectric focusing and gel electrophoresis, will any of these proteins interact with RHG1? Leucine-rich repeat from RLK. And indeed one does, very strongly and repeatably, and this spot turns out not to be a very strongly abundant protein, so it's not an artificial effect, it really is a specific interaction, and we got peptides from that interacting protein and got a very high degree of association with a cyclophilin. Now those of you who haven't followed the resistance press recently won't know that cyclophilins have been implicated in a number of systems. And basically what a cyclophilin does is two things. It changes the structure of other proteins by an isomerization effect on the peptide bond of the backbone, and binds to small molecule effectors. So here we have the classic case of a cyclophilin binding cyclosporin A. And presenting it to two receptor-like kinase molecules that then go off and effect a response to the drug. You see there's a very close binding and there's a pocket here. It looks kind of, to me, with wishing powder, a little bit like our system. There are lots of cyclophilins in soybean. These are the tentative contigs that we can find in the EST collection, and ours is just one of those. So it's specific in the sense that there are lots of other structural variants on that 2D gel that aren't being found. What we know about the cyclophilin that we are detecting is it's probably a highly expressed gene because it has no intron. Their SNPs are rare, Williams 82 to Forrest. We don't have it from Asgrow, 3244. The MAP location seems to be on linkage group N, which needs to be verified, but it's very exciting because that, as you will remember, is the locus that has to be co-inherited. The cyclophilin is expressed in many organs, we can tell from an in silico analysis, and paralogs of it are manifold. We're currently involved in trying to do a three-way interaction. We have the CLE domain from a protein produced by the nematode, which is a Clavata 3 ortholog. Our RLK at RHG1 is a Clavata 1 ortholog, and we'd be very interested to see if two-way or three-way interactions occur. There's a lot of excitement about cyclophilins involved in resistance. It was started by Staskowitz's group, and here's just a set of papers that talk about the involvement of cyclophilins in plant disease resistance. I'd recommend looking out this one by Cochran, Staskowitz, and Science. But with all this high-powered molecular genetics and now proteomics, we're still left with unresolved questions. How can RHG1 be codominant, and what do we mean by that? What happens to the, if we're killing 50% of the cyst nematodes in certain germplasm backgrounds, why are 50% killed and 50% left to thrive? Can RSG1 really be a locus containing more than one gene, or are we just misidentifying what the basis of resistance is? How can the variant lacase and the other five genes be part of the RSG1 locus? How is it that they're kept together as a unit whilst breeders are trying to throw recombinations in there? Why do those five genes track through germplasm as a group? And how can one gene locus impact resistance to all HG types? Why is it at the center? So, questions to be resolved in future. What we can say is that SCN root invasion is a highly involved interaction with many stages. If there be seven discernible morphological and physiological levels to a root knot nematode plant interaction, then SCN probably has seven of those. It's a very complex system, and we think the molecular approach, the proteomic approach, will give us answers to those questions in the coming months and years.
Okay, so do we have questions?
If we had a functional assay, we'd be able to answer that question. Our problem at the moment is partially functional assays. We can take, we can knock out each of these genes and have a small effect in composite plant roots on the overall phenotype, but none of them provides the knockout punch to resistance. So each of them has a small effect, none of them have a big effect. Eliminating dimerization would be an exciting thing, but it's hard to imagine how we'd have to be at the level of doing allele replacements. So I couldn't really answer that.